Hello, everybody. Do you love bedtime stories that spark the imagination? Bed Critters is the delightful children's book that brings crazy creatures and sleepy time magic to life. Now available on Amazon. Just search Bed Critters or look for it wherever you buy books. Hello, this is Kennedy Weibel from Reading Pop Classics with a quick note before you listen to this episode. We had some unfortunate connectivity and technical issues while we were recording this. We think we've solved that in the long term, and future episodes shouldn't have these same issues. But if while you're listening to this particular episode, you think to yourself that it sounds like it was recorded on a butt and edited on a potato, that's why. Anyhow, thanks for your patience. Thank you for listening. We think we've got it sorted out in the future. Enjoy the episode.
Ah, to be a human, for whom bliss can be achieved by mere ignorance. Marcellus in Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Weibel.
And you're listening to Reading Pop Classics, the podcast where we discuss modern literary classics, or if not quite classics, books that at the very least are incredibly popular and widely read. Today we're discussing Shelby Van Pelt's 2022 bestseller, Remarkably Bright Creatures. This is an interesting book for us to cover. It has possibly the strongest claim of anything we've covered so far to be included in a podcast that wants to look at populist books, books that are on real people's shelves and get read. Because this wasn't an immediate bestseller. It did fine, I think, when it came out. But as every article about its success points out, it got big later on via word of mouth. People told their friends, you got to read this. And booksellers over and over in those same articles tell the story about those requests of people coming in and being like, do you have the octopus book? My friend recommended this octopus book and so forth. Readers very much made this a book, a bestseller, more than a marketing campaign did. And Shelby Van Pelt built the book off a writing prompt that she got in a writing workshop she was in. And the prompt was to write a scene with an unlikely narrator. And she had watched some octopus videos on YouTube about how smart they are and how cool octopi are. And so she chose that as her unlikely voice. And here we are. Rebecca, did you like this?
I thought this was a fun, enjoyable read, kind of like A Man Called Ove, honestly. A Man Called Ove, I suppose, had some sadder things in it. And this has a little undercurrent of sadness, like in our main character. But I did think it was like a fun, sweet read.
I did not enjoy this.
No, you really didn't. I got several texts throughout the reading of this book about how you were not enjoying it, which for our listeners is rare. We actually don't really talk about the books very much before we do our podcast. We kind of read them and save our discussion for the podcast. So that's how much he disliked this, as I kept getting texts about him not liking this book as we were reading it.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy it, but I am prepared to talk about it dispassionately. I'll use a word that I've made up. I don't know if we've talked about this before. Appreciate. It's a portmanteau. I invented it. And I use it to describe books that, like, I didn't enjoy this. I didn't like it, but I get it. Like, I get why other people enjoyed it. Lord of the Rings is like that for me. Like, there's nothing in this that I like, but I totally understand why it is popular and why other people do like it. I get that if you're into fantasy, this is written in a very literary fashion. It's very deep. It has all sorts of lore and languages and background to it. It's a very rich text. Nothing there for me particularly, but I totally get it. This falls into that. I see why it's popular. It's a simple story that is well told, that moves forward at a pretty brisk pace. It's got some charming, like, little whimsical elements to it. It's emotional. It centers on family.
I can see that. This was recommended to me by a few different people. This was first recommended to me by a coworker who raved about it. Another girlfriend recommended it to me, and also with a, like, oh my gosh, like, you have to read this. It's amazing. It's so good. And then ultimately this book landed in my lap from our mother, who also said that she had enjoyed it and suggested that I read it as well. And those three recommendations, and the fact that I've seen it on book lists. I've seen it on, we often talk about, like, the table at the front of the bookshop. So I've seen this on a lot of tables at the front of the bookshop. This is not my favorite thing that I've ever read. I would not rave about this book to somebody else, but much like you, I understand what it is other people, I do understand why other people are raving about it, but I did think it was an enjoyable read. And my favorite part of the book, honestly, is Marcellus, and it's his voice and it's his chapters. I was immediately charmed by him. It reminded me a little bit of those Henri the Cat videos that were popular on YouTube like many years ago, Henri the Existential Cat. And that is what Marcellus reminded me of. And I liked that there was a little bit of a mystery. I liked that we were unraveling something. I was genuinely curious and interested to know what happened to Tova's son and how this octopus was going to help her figure it out. And this is a clever book. I think it's a different story. Like you said, that the writing prompt that Shelby Van Pelt received was to write from like an unlikely character and an unlikely voice. So I do think this is like original. And then this is part of maybe why you didn't feel like there was a lot for you in this book. But I do think that an octopus and an older woman are unusual, unique main characters. And I think that lends something to this book.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I also think that it goes a long way to explaining why it's popular, right? These are also recognizable characters from readers' lives, right? There's a grandmother. There's a younger guy as a co-protagonist. The octopus gives it this little whimsical, unexpected element. All of it adds up. It's just not for me. But so starting at the top of the plot, we start with Marcellus, an octopus who lives in an aquarium. He's old. He lets us know that he's probably dying soon. And he's completely sentient. Tova is a 70 to 72-year-old woman who cleans the aquarium. Her husband has passed away. Her son died years ago when he was 18 out on a boat. And it's been ruled a suicide, right? Because they're not really sure what happened. He just never came back. Like, they found his body later on and they found his boat, right?
One night she saves
Marcellus when he gets out of his tank. Yeah, they found the boat. They find his body?
No, his body isn't found, which is why his body's not found, so they can't determine what happened based on that. They never find him. It's a mystery, essentially, even for the police, and they just rule it a suicide because they can't find out any more information. And because I think he was, like, he's an athlete, he's been out on a boat before, so it seemed less likely that something happened. And it's not like he went out in a storm.
And there's nothing in his life at the moment, according to his mother, that would indicate a suicide. He wasn't particularly unhappy.
He was a popular guy. He had friends. This was a all-American kid. So yes, to your point, it wasn't like he had some history of like mental health issues or some unhappiness or some large thing that was going on that would make him want to die by suicide.
So Tova is a widower at this point because her husband has passed away now too. And mostly, I think, just to have something to fill her time. She cleans at the aquarium at night. And she has a friend group that she hangs out with on and off during the day called the Knitwits. Knit as in K-N-I-T, I guess, because they used to knit. They don't actually knit at any point within the book.
It started as a knitting club, and it has just become like a years-long friendship among this group of women that are all now around Tova's age.
And that is kind of funny. They're called that, and then they don't knit ever. It's not a knitting circle. Like, they just hang out and bring each other food and have lunch.
Yeah, I like that.
And so at the beginning of Tova's story, we find all this out about her, and then her brother dies in a very fancy retirement home called the Charter Village. And then our other main protagonist is Cameron, who is a 30-year-old absolute loser. Right? Like, he's just...
He's a loser, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the book wants us to feel a little bit of a affection for him. I had a hard time with Cameron. He plays in a band called Moth Sausage, which is funny. It's a funny name.
It is a funny name. I like that.
And in the beginning, he loses his job and his girlfriend kicks him out. He's an orphan. He was raised by his aunt.
He's not quite an orphan because we don't know if his mom's dead or not. And he doesn't know anything about his father. His mom leaves him with the aunt.
Yes, I guess he doesn't know where she is. He's never heard from her. And she could, I suppose at the end of the book, she could still be out there, right? We don't know.
Yeah, because I think it's at the end of the book, his aunt is going to try to find her.
And his mom was a drug addict, of some unspecified type of drug addict. She's an addict the way King Lear was mad, just sort of a general madness, no specifics. So Cameron lives down, like, I don't know, middle California, and Tova lives in, are they in Seattle or Oregon?
Well, we should know that.
I'm sure at some point I know it in the book.
We do know it at some point in the book. I'm pretty sure they're in Washington. I think they're near Seattle. I'm pretty sure they're in Washington State. I think they're down.
Oh, because, like, she drives to Seattle for the shirt.
Because she drives to Seattle. Yeah, I think that they're, I'm pretty sure they're in Washington. Washington and Oregon kind of run together for me, is just some of the most beautiful part of our country. But I forget sometimes that they are separate states.
I also forget which one is on top a lot. Pretty sure it's Washington.
Washington is on top. Yeah.
So Cameron's aunt, who raised him and who has chlamydia, which we know because he finds her STD test when he's cleaning up her, like, very hoarder-esque trailer that she lives in a little trailer community. She gives him a box of his mother's things when he's over at her, over one day, solving some issue around her plants and a possible snake that was, like, residing within her plants. She gives him a box of his mother's stuff, and he's never really wanted anything to do with his mom or wanted any of her stuff before, but she kind of bullies him into taking this box that he just finally accepts and, like, throws in his truck and goes back home to his apartment, where his girlfriend finds out that he lost his job again, and she throws him out, and she throws all of his stuff out the window. So he goes to stay with his best friend, who's a woman, and his best friend's husband, who was, like, another guy in their friend group that
she married. Well, I think he's best friends with both of them. I think he's best friends with both of them. The two of them just happened to grow up to date and then get married, but they have both been, like, childhood friends. They were, like, a little trio, and then two of the trio paired off.
He has a little internal monologue, though, at one point about how the guy, whatever his name is, was a little, he was surprised when they got married. Brad, he was on the outside. And Brad is in his band, though. Brad is in Moth Sausage. So yes, you're right. They're friends. So he's staying with them while he tries to figure out what to do. And one night while he's up, he goes through the box of his mom's things and he finds a ring wrapped in a page from a yearbook. It's a high school class ring wrapped in a yearbook page. And in the yearbook page, she's in a picture with some guy. And he decides that the guy in that picture must be his dad. He finds the name. Maybe it's on the page, or maybe he finds the yearbook. I can't remember, but he finds the guy's name. He looks him up, and it turns out the guy is rich. So Cameron decides that he's going to go to the town where this guy is from, where he believes he still lives, and confront him and demand, like, back child support because he doesn't have any money and he feels like this guy should give him some. And this is where Cameron immediately starts to fall apart for me. I don't know if this plan is a poor plan.
Yeah, I have a hard time. I legitimately have a hard time rooting for Cameron throughout this book.
Like, he doesn't communicate with the guy in any way or make any attempt to find out how to communicate with him. He just decides that the last little bit of money he's got, he's going to buy a plane ticket and go to this town where the guy's from. And the town where the guy is from is the town where Tova lives. Like, he's going to Tova's town. But he doesn't, like, make any attempt to communicate with him first. He doesn't find him online somewhere and reach out. He just flies to the nearest airport.
And part of it's that he just basically wants to go ask for money, when it's like, you have one unreliable parent and you've never known about the other, and you find something that, like, leads you to believe you could have this other parent, and then your only concern is to go demand money from him. It makes him immediately unlikable, in my opinion.
There's also zero evidence this man is his father. There's no suggestion whatsoever in any of the things he finds, like, nothing concrete. This is just a guy in a yearbook posed with his mother.
And
it could be anybody. but he makes the decision right then and there. Do you know what an idiot plot is? Have you ever heard the term idiot plot?
I think so, but I couldn't put words to it.
It's where the plot of a novel or a movie or whatever requires, it only works because one of the characters is an absolute idiot. Now, this is not the same as like a story about idiots. Lots of stories about idiots. That's a separate thing, but like it requires a character to just be dumb in a way that like is highly improbable. And I think this qualifies. Like everything Cameron does is just out of a nearly inhuman stupidity. Which is weird because Cameron keeps telling us how smart he is. Like the book keeps telling us that Cameron's like actually a really, really smart guy. Like almost like genius kind of guy.
Correct.
And no evidence for it anywhere in the book. It doesn't really come up.
It's like he has a photographic memory. He remembers things that he's read. He remembers things that he's seen on TV that are factual. But this is also, there's that difference between street smart and other, there's lots of different types of smart. Yeah, there's common sense. And then there's uncommon sense. And sometimes people are incredibly smart and could answer every Jeopardy question that you've ever seen, but their interpersonal skills are terrible. They have zero common sense, or they don't make good life choices, which is Cameron. They don't have their act together. So there's different kinds of smart. So we do keep hearing that he's like very smart, but he's not somebody who is like together. He doesn't have like usable, useful smart.
No, he's like Jeopardy. He's like trivia smart. Is what it appears to be throughout the book. He remembers random factoids and quotes, and he's seen a documentary here and there, and he remembers pieces of the documentary. But I would argue the way it's presented in the book, that isn't even like Jeopardy smart. That's just you saw a documentary and you remember some of what you saw. That's just being alive for the most part. That's just being, you know, just someone who can see and hear and remember things, some things, occasionally.
Yeah, his smart is definitely his smart is definitely
the town where Tova lives.
It's definitely tell not show his smartness.
So he's off to the town where Tova lives. So meanwhile, after the rescue, after Tova has rescued Marcellus, who gets out of his tank at night, wanders around the aquarium, he gets tangled up in some extension cords or something and can't get free one night, and Tova untangles him and he gets back to his tank and he lives. And Marcellus likes Tova because of this. And Tova starts visiting with Marcellus and telling Marcellus about her son, Eric. And Marcellus knows who this is. Like Marcellus recognizes some piece of Tova that matches up with some remains that he has found at the bottom of the sea back before his capture, right?
Yes.
And so Marcellus knows that her son drowned or was dead at the bottom of the ocean at any rate, and takes an affection for Tova and feels very much that like her heart is heavy. And like, I think he makes the comment that there's a hole in it that he wants to fill up.
Oh, I can quote it. Hold, please.
One night she falls at work and she, okay, hit me.
This is in the voice of Marcellus. As a general rule, I like holes. A hole at the top of my tank gives me freedom, but I do not like the hole in her heart. She only has one, not three, like me. Tova's heart. I will do everything I can to help her fill it. I think that's very sweet. And I like that. And I like the little octopus facts that he spits out at us throughout the book, like how he has three hearts compared to our one.
The Marcellus like whole thing is very cute. I think there could be more Marcellus in this book.
There could be more Marcellus.
I also understand that it's probably difficult to create a plot around I imagine it's difficult to create a plot all the way around a giant Pacific octopus that is in a tank and lives in an aquarium and can't really get out. But the book could do with more Marcellus. So Cameron flies to Washington, and when he lands at the airport, his bag that he checked with everything in it that he needs doesn't show up. And he meets a guy while he's waiting for the bag to... While he's waiting in the baggage area, he meets a vegan who says that his friend has a camper he'll sell him. And because Cameron just makes decisions like this, he decides he's going to buy that camper for this excursion to go to drive the rest of the way up to this little, to Sowell Bay, which is where Tova lives and where his mother went to high school.
And he has to call his aunt and like ask her
the money for money. Aunt Chlamydia.
Oh, yeah, we're calling her Aunt Chlamydia for the rest of this podcast.
So he drives it up to Sowell Bay, where he meets Ethan, the Scottish grocer who serves the town of Sowell Bay at his little market. And Ethan, the grocer, lets him park his camper in his driveway and stay with him. And he gets him a job at the aquarium doing maintenance. And because Tova has fallen off a stool, I think while talking to Marcellus, and twisted her ankle, Cameron, for a little while, gets extra work at the aquarium cleaning while Tova is on leave with her busted ankle. So that's what brings Cameron. That's how our two protagonists are brought to the same area, and that's how they end up in the same aquarium, and that's how they end up both in the circle, in the realm of Marcellus. So Cameron's next move is he goes to a real estate office there in town, because he thinks that because the woman who works there is in real estate, she'll know the guy he thinks is his father because he's in real estate. And he actually has the exchange where he's like, well, you're in real estate. He's in real estate. Can't you put me in touch with him? Which again is just so arbitrarily and randomly stupid. Like they don't work for the same company, I don't believe. Like this woman's just a real estate agent in this town.
Real estate agents do work together. Like if you're my real estate agent and I'm interested in a certain house and that house is represented by another real estate agent, they work together. But yes, it is a bit of a stretch on his part. He is grasping at straws.
You work in occupational therapy. You don't know every occupational therapist. Obviously, you know some other occupational therapists, but you don't know all of them. If I just picked one and told you to get me in touch with him.
That's true.
It's like the high school game where you're sort of like, oh, you're from that town. Do you know some, or the college game, I'm sorry. Like, oh, do you know this person? Like, yeah, it's a 30,000 person university. I don't necessarily know that guy.
Yeah.
But while he's in there talking to her, so he's been sleeping in the camper, which is in worse shape than he thought. He just bought it sight unseen. But it's in bad shape. The mattress has smelled like pee, and he's been sleeping in it. So he's dirty. He's unshowered. He smells like pee. And while he is in there smelling like pee, all dirty and disheveled, asking this woman to put him in touch with this random other real estate, like scion, the woman from next door who rents paddle boards comes in to complain about the water pressure, because I guess the real estate agent is the landlord for the building where she rents her space for the paddleboard rentals.
Yeah. No, I think
and
the water's
Cameron
cold.
Cameron inexplicably gets a date.
Yeah. I'm so annoyed that she gives her number to a guy who she says smells like pee. Like this girl comes in, she like owns her own business. She's like somebody who's like together. She's not impressed by this guy. She thinks that he's gross and like she still gives him her number, and I'm annoyed with her for doing that.
Yeah, Cameron is an absolute disaster, but he had a really successful and I'm going to say hot girlfriend before. And I'm going to say that just because the narration tells us that she had a perky butt.
Yeah.
Right? When he's watching her walk around the apartment.
Yeah. So Cameron's probably a good looking guy. But yeah, Avery just seems like she wouldn't be into this guy. And so I'm annoyed that she gives him her number and goes on a date with him when he's gross and seems like an idiot.
Also a complete stranger. Like she knows nothing about him except that he's sitting in there smelling like pee and looking like utterly disheveled. I don't know. The book, it seems like for the book that like there just needs to be this little relationship so it happens because it needs to happen. Absolutely no compelling reason why like Avery
because
would give this guy the time of day.
Because we start with Cameron, because Cameron has to have a total and complete turnaround because he starts out such a loser. He loses his job. He loses his, initially in life, he's never had a dad that he knows of. His mom leaves him. When we meet him in the book, he's lost his job. His girlfriend dumps him. So he just needs to have a complete turnaround. So like having a female love interest that like can see the diamond in the rough is just has to be part of his like turnaround, because he's going to gain like a girlfriend, a job, and a family by the end of the book.
Yes. And so the thing that I did not mention about Ethan, the grocer who is Scottish, who is letting Cameron park his camper in his driveway and stay there, is that Ethan is in love with Tova.
Which is adorable. I ship Ethan and Tova real hard in this book, I have to say.
Ethan is also one of the town's preeminent gossips, right? Like he stands there at the cashier checkout line. Yeah, telling everybody else's business, collecting more details from each person who comes through to pass those along. Tova finds this unacceptable, or not unacceptable, but she doesn't care for it. And she's hesitant around Ethan because of that. She doesn't really seem to have a sense that he likes her. That comes later, right? Like she doesn't seem to catch on that he's like, that he fancies her, as he says.
No, I don't think she knows until he like legitimately, I think, asks her out. And then she's sort of like, oh no. And she avoids him for a little.
So Tova had a brother, and the brother passes away during the course of the narrative. And they fell out of communication, I think, after Eric, her son, died, right?
Yeah, but I don't feel like we get much of a, I don't feel like we really get that decent of an explanation of like why she and her brother are so estranged. Do we?
No, the way it's explained to us is it just happened. I think she didn't really like the guy her brother was she didn't really like the woman her brother was seeing, but not even really disliked her, just they weren't the best of friends. And just time, they just drifted apart and stopped speaking entirely. The manner in which they are estranged seems fairly dramatic compared to the explanation we get, which is that they just fell out of touch. But like someone has to call, like, I don't know that she even knew he was dying. Like,
no, I think she just like finds out that he dies and she's not even super upset about it.
No, she doesn't seem to mind. But she gets Ethan to give her a ride up to Charter House, the very fancy pants retirement community where her brother lived, to collect his things, the things that are left there. And Ethan's all excited because it's like a date and he gets to drive her up there. So when they go up there and she takes a look at it, she makes the decision that like she's going to also live at Charter House because she's alone. She doesn't have anybody. She doesn't count her friends.
Well, her friends have their own stuff. Like one of them is married. One of them is going to go live with their daughter. Another one also has a son who like I think is well off and takes her out to fancy restaurants and can care for her. So Tova, I think, is just coming towards getting a little older and looking at her friends of like, well, they all have people that are going to take care that can take care of them and be there for them, and I don't have that. So she wants to preempt the need almost to be cared for by going to Charter Village. And I will say, this is a valid storyline. Maybe I liked this book a little bit more than you because I do work with seniors. I work with seniors, right? So it's like, I do see and understand this. I do have a sort of a different perspective on this storyline.
I do not disagree. I think this is a valid storyline. When I said she doesn't count her friends, I guess what I meant was that she doesn't count them as people who are going to take care of her. She's independent. She's an adult. She doesn't want to be a burden to someone else. And her friends are also her age. She's not expecting them to like take on the care of another person. And that's completely reasonable. They're upset about it because they feel like she's leaving the community and everyone she knows. They see it much differently. They see it as like, of course, we will help take care of you. We are your family. We have been here since... We've known you forever. We've been here through you losing your son. We've been here through you losing your husband. We've all been together and we've all taken care of each other. And obviously we will help take care of you. Please don't go to a retirement community. Like, this is your home. Like, you don't know anybody up there. And I also really like that she's not going to, their concern is not that it's a derelict home that isn't going to do a good job and or anything like that. It's apparently a very expensive, well-appointed, super luxury retirement community that she's trying to go to. Like, them wanting her to stay is a genuine, genuine feeling of this is where you belong and this is where you're going to be happy. You're not going to be pleased up there.
Yes, because they, because to your point, like, yes, like, I think it's like they see that she is discounting like the friendships and the relationships and the sense of community. And that's their view on it. And her view is, I don't want to be a burden. I'm going to be a burden on this community and a burden on you. I'm not now. But she has a little bit of that scare, I think, because she falls and twists her ankle.
Yep.
So she is somebody who's, she's in good health, more or less, right? Like, for her age and whatever. But it's then this like small thing happens and it's like, oh, you know, my friends are having to come over and bring me food. And it does, I think it scares her a little bit. I work with seniors, so I see these things play out. I see what life looks like for somebody that's older and needs care when they do have family around and community around, and I see what happens when they don't too. And I think that's the reason that this book is popular, is because it is something that we're talking about, because people are living longer. People are living to be older. So this is a much larger part of the conversation than I think it was 30 years ago, when we didn't have such long health outcomes and life outlooks for people.
And Tova's thoughts about herself and her position in the world mirror Marcellus. Marcellus in the beginning, who tells us, like, I have maybe one or two good years left in octopus years, right? I'm going to die soon. It's going to be here in this tank, in this aquarium, in this town, not like out in the world where I'm supposed to be. But he also has this like fatalistic view of his own position. And Tova's got that as well.
Yeah, they do have those parallel, it's like a parallel storyline in some sense.
Yeah, I've run my race. I had a son, I had a husband. They're both gone now. I'm at the end. I'm just killing time at this aquarium. And I should just go get myself set up somewhere where I can be looked after in the declining years.
And not be a burden.
Everyone's upset.
And then I think the thought on that too is just like, then I'm not a burden because I'm paying for it. The people who were caring for me here are paid to do so. And so therefore I'm not a burden. I am paying my way for this. I like that Shelby Van Pelt has taken these, because I think she gets this writing prompt on like an unlikely narrator. And then I think she pulls a storyline that is less popular, that is not running through everything. We have a little bit of like, we have the romance and stuff, or like the idiot plot. And here we have a little bit of a mystery about how Eric has died. And those are all more like familiar. Those are more familiar things to us from reading. Whereas I feel like the narration coming from an octopus and the storyline about what the world might look like through the eyes of a 70-year-old woman are more, you know, sort of unique takes.
So after she comes back from there, she's made her decision that she's going to check herself in. She goes to the aquarium one night to visit Marcellus. And that's where she bumps into Cameron for the first time. And what is it? Cameron's like up on, I think he's up on the same stool that she fell off of. And he's trying to like jab Marcellus back into his tank. Is that what he's doing?
He's got like a broom or something, and he's using the handle. He's trying to like, he's trying to goad him back into the tank. Like, he doesn't know what to do with him. And he knows that he thinks he's not supposed to be out roaming around.
Well, he's 100% not supposed to be roaming around. Tova's just like letting it go. But no, he's 100% not supposed to be roaming the aquarium at night, eating leftovers out of the fridge.
I like that he keeps eating the sea cucumbers. They keep having to replace the sea cucumbers because he goes into their tank and eats them.
I also think it's very funny that Marcellus is aware that he needs to eat these other animals at a speed which does not bring suspicion upon him.
Yeah, I like that
but
too.
But he's failing at it. He gets overexcited sometimes. So that's where they first meet. And Marcellus recognizes that they are related and tells us that they are related, which is an interesting choice, because it's maybe around the middle of the book that, as the reader, I think it becomes very obvious where this is going.
Yeah.
It's not like veiled or something that like you go back and read later and you're like, oh, the clue was there. Marcellus just tells us like those two people are blood relatives. And so the only way for that to be possible, given the ages of everybody and the limited characters that we have within the book, is that Cameron is her grandson and her son had a relationship with Cameron's mother, Daphne Casmore. So the two of them keep meeting and bumping into each other as Tova keeps coming to visit Marcellus at night. So Cameron and Avery go out on a paddleboard date. Not their first date, but they go out on a paddleboard date. I think it's the first time Cameron has come over to Avery's house.
Yes.
They go out on a paddleboard date and they go out and frolic in the sea. Avery tells him the story. They paddle up next to the pier, which is next to the aquarium. And Avery tells him this story about how one night she was paddleboarding, or one like dusk or something like that, she was paddleboarding around there and saw a woman who was going to, it looked very much to Avery like she was going to jump off the pier, like as a suicide. And Avery talks her down, I think.
Yes, she does.
We get that story. So the paddleboard date goes well, and then they bounce, chicka-bow, bow. Again, no real explanation of why she would like this guy, but there we are. So they're seeing each other. Meanwhile, Tova is out like just in a park one day where she bumps into a man on a bicycle and has a little bit of a conversation with him, gives him some water. He's like cycling around. And then a little bit later at a dinner with all of the nitwits, she meets this man again. And
when they meet in the park, it turns out that he knew Eric. He went to high school with Eric, her son. So they established that in the park.
Oh, does that get revealed in the park?
It gets revealed in the park. They weren't very good. I don't think they were very good friends or anything, but they knew each other and they were in high school together. He's like in Eric's class. So that does get revealed in the park. So she's pleased to see him at this luncheon. The luncheon's for one of the nitwits that's moving in with their daughter, I think.
Yes. I can't remember why the man is there or his wife. They're connected, though, to the nitwits. Though,
yeah,
in some
I was just
going to
say. They're
friends of the daughter or something like that.
Yeah.
And he gets really drunk at the lunch, and he reveals that Eric had been seeing this girl, and Tova has never heard of this girl. Tova did not know at the time that her son was seeing anybody, that her son was in a relationship. She's thrilled to know this extra little piece of news and this piece of her son's world all these years later. But the guy gets really drunk at lunch, and everybody's worried that Tova's going to get upset because they're talking about her dead son. So there's no more information given to us, just that Eric was seeing a girl. This guy knew her. He can't remember her name. And then the lunch ends. So then Ethan, the Scottish grocer, works up the nerve to ask Tova to come over for dinner. And he has somehow put together that Daphne Casmore is Cameron's mother. Because he had did he have a sign up that was like, do not accept checks from this woman in the grocer or something like that?
Whoever owned the store before him would like shame people who bounced checks, who wrote bad checks. And Daphne Casmore.
Which was very much a thing. I remember
that being a thing too. That's definitely a throwback for those of us who were old enough to remember checks. And yeah, so it's like her name is
when you could write a check at a store or
so he puts together that
when you could write a check at a store for goods and service. So what happens? So after that dinner, Tova bumps into that man's wife, Sandy Hewitt, in Ethan's grocery store. And Sandy is talking to Tova and is like, by the way, my husband remembered the name of that woman. It was Daphne Casmore. That was her name. Ethan overhears this and puts together the last names Casmore. And he remembers Daphne Casmore because when he bought the grocer, Daphne Casmore was one of the like do not accept check ladies pictures that was up by the cash register, which Ethan has taken down. He does not do that. But the former owner, back when that was a thing, had the like, you know, don't accept checks from Daphne Casmore. And he puts the names together. And what he overhears when Sandy is telling Tova this is he realizes that Cameron's mother used to live there and that Cameron's mother knows something about the boy who went missing all those years ago, who is Tova's son.
Correct.
And so he invites Tova over for dinner because he's going to tell Tova this. So before he can tell her this at dinner, Cameron comes barging in, angry. I think both because Ethan won't give him a job at the grocery store. And he's angry that Ethan feels he wouldn't be up to it. And I got to say, Cameron has done nothing, as far as I can tell, to suggest to anybody that he would be up to something like this. But he's mad about that. So they get interrupted before Ethan can tell Tova his news. And then while Ethan has excused himself to talk with Cameron and try to calm him down, but they're just fighting, Tova, because she always needs to be in motion and kind of like doing something, starts cleaning up the kitchen. And she finds a rag under the sink, cleans up the kitchen with it, including some spilled wine. And the rag turns out to be this incredibly valuable, both monetarily and emotionally for Ethan, Jerry Garcia Grateful Dead t-shirt that Ethan inexplicably keeps in the little closet, as he calls it, under his sink. Did I get that right?
Yep. You have it right. Yeah, he's just like a messy guy. Like when she's looking for like stuff, like when she's looking around to like clean, she's finding like weird things in weird places because Ethan is a man who's been single for a long time and is apparently a mess.
Okay.
But it
it
interrupts the evening and he does not end up getting to tell her about Daphne Casmore. What were you going to say?
Some editor should have said, could the shirt just be somewhere else? Besides under the kitchen sink, and then have this man try to justify that that's where he keeps not all of his clothing, but this one particular special shirt because he thinks of it as a little closet. Like, I'm not from Scotland. I don't know how they do things in Scotland, but I'm almost positive they don't keep their clothing under the sink. I'll take that with zero research. I'll bet that I'm right about that. The shirt just should have been somewhere else. A pile of rags that she finds on the counter, and the shirt's so crummy looking that she has to believe it's a rag.
I'm with you. Yeah, I'm picking up what you're putting down.
This argument about like why would the shirt be under the sink? And he's like, you mean the little closet down there? What? What? No. That's insane. That's an insane plot point. I'm saying it. That's a ridiculous plot point. And there's a bunch of scribbles all over the several pages where this happens in the book that I've only written mean things. They're not like thoughtful. They're not analysis. They're just angry like musings on the side of the page. That's a ridiculous plot point and it should have been removed. Shirt should have just been somewhere else. But anyhow, the night is ruined. Ethan doesn't get to tell her the news. Cameron storms out and he's mad at Ethan also. Tova feels terrible about the shirt. So she gets someone to help her go online and find someone who is selling another one of these shirts. And it's, I don't know, several hundreds of dollars because it's a collector's item because Jerry Garcia is now dead. And it's a shirt from, I think, maybe the last show before he died. I don't remember precisely what the description is in the book, but it's something to that effect. And then she drives herself to Seattle to pick it up because she has to have it right away. So Cameron has also at this point found out that the Brinks guy, the man who he believes is his father, is named Brinks. Name Brinks. And he owns a real estate company called Brinks Real Estate or something like that. Someone finally gets back to him. He's been calling and calling and like kind of stretching the truth a little bit more each time about who he is and why he needs to get in touch with this guy. And someone finally tells him that the guy wants to meet with them and gives him an address. On this day, Ethan is supposed to meet Avery for a date. And so he stops by her paddleboard shop and tells her 13-year-old son to please let Avery know when she comes in and a little while later that he's not going to make their date and he'll give her a call later on.
And the 13-year-old takes the opportunity to put a kink in this guy's plans by not sharing that with Avery.
Right. So Avery just believes she's been stood up. Cameron has a phone that has text messaging on it because it's the modern world. Avery also has a phone that receives text messages. But this is how Cameron chooses to deal with this. And so anyhow, he goes off to the address to meet this Brinks guy. And it's at this sort of speakeasy cocktail bar, like a town or two over. And he goes down and he meets this guy. And the guy's like, I'm so happy to meet you. This drink's on me. Like, I recognized your name and I'm excited to meet you. And it turns out that he was Daphne Casmore's best friend, was never her lover, was never in a relationship with her. They've never had sex. Like, it's impossible that he would be Cameron's father. But he has heard of Cameron. He knew that Cameron was living down with his aunt. And he has built the bar that they're in, the Mud Minnow Bar and Grill, whatever it's called. He has built it and named it for Cameron's mother because it was an idea that she had that they used to talk about when they were younger, I think.
Yes, that's correct.
So Cameron is crushed, and then he comes out to back to his camper. And he, because Avery has not written him back, decides that Avery is ghosting him and that that relationship is also dead and that there's nothing left for him anymore in this area, and he's going to drive back home.
This is a very Cameron, this is a very early book Cameron decision.
Yeah, I would say there's a lot in the scene that I don't think necessarily adds up, but it gives us some resolution, right? Like, we find out that, like, the guy he's been pursuing has not been, like, avoiding him. He was on a vacation first, and then it just took a little while for him to get the message. And then when he did get the message, he put the names together right away and then told his assistant or whoever it was to have this guy meet him at this bar where he reveals all this. So we find out that the Brinks guy is not his father. We've known that because Marcellus told us that he is related to Tova. And now he's just driving his crummy camper back down to wherever he lives in Central California. And he's given up on the whole area. He's ghosting his job. Oh, wait, he talks to Tova.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at it right now. He talks to Tova. We are doing a terrible job. He goes back and talks to Tova and is like, yeah, like, my girlfriend's ghosting me. This guy's not even my dad. He takes the class ring that has E-E-L-S engraved on the inside of it and drops it into the tank with the eels. E-E-L-S, eels. And he drops it into the tank with the eels at the aquarium.
Right. And he's like,
I'm quitting and leaving. And Tova's there. So he's like telling her this. Tova's there. He's like, I'm quitting, I'm leaving. And she's like, no, like, you're better than this. Don't be this way. And he's like, no, I'm not better than this. And puts a letter on the desk for Terry, the guy who runs the aquarium.
Yes. He's leaving a note for Terry to say that he's not coming back. But he is not giving 2 weeks' notice.
No, he's just
leaving. And Tova is disappointed in him. Yeah. And so then he leaves and he's driving back to Central California. Cameron makes a lot of really big assumptions over this stretch of the book. That's kind of Cameron's thing, is making lots of really big assumptions about things and then acting on them with no evidence that any of them are correct. And he does that again here. Yeah, and he throws the class ring into the eel tank, and all of this happens in front of Marcellus. And then we get a Marcellus chapter where it's a little bit funny that he's like, day whatever of my captivity, and then it cuts off. He just goes, oh, let's cut the shit, shall we? We have a ring to go retrieve.
Yeah, that's cute.
This is one of my least favorite things, though, in books in general, is when, you might remember this from when we were both reading the Stephen King's Dark Tower series at the same time. and I really disliked book number 4, Wizard and Glass.
No, you hate Wizard and Glass so much.
Because every time, like, the framework of that story is that Roland is telling his other companions the story that we're reading, the story that is the main narrative of the novel. And every time it cuts back to him telling the story, he keeps going, love stories are boring. This is a boring story and no one wants to hear it and I shouldn't be telling it. And I agreed with Roland, and I find it annoying when it seems a little bit to me like authors realize that they're writing things that, like, aren't, when their frustration with their own material comes through in the actual book, I find that irritating. Like Stephen King, okay, so you do know this is a boring story. You're aware that you're boring me. You have a character who keeps saying it. Why are you doing this? Why is it a book? Why am I 250 pages into this? And that's a little bit how I took that too. Like, oh, let's cut the shit. We have a ring to get. And I'm like, okay, so you know we just need to wrap this up, Shelby Van Pelt. As you were writing it, you were like, oh God, we just need to get to the end of this. And it bothers me that not only do you know it, you're aware of it, you're doing it anyway, but you're also going to put it in the book so that I know that you know it and you still did it. I find that some sort of betrayal of trust between me and the author whenever it happens. And I felt much the same when I read that part. And I was like, oh, guys, so you realize we're just trying to, like, that a lot of this is filler for a plot that we already know the end of. And that you're just putting words on a page because this needs to be a certain length to be a book.
We do get something I do like about this chapter, though, is that we do, because we find out, like, a little earlier in the book that Marcellus was injured when he was brought to the aquarium. That is part of the reason that he is in captivity, is because he was injured and they rehabilitated him and then made him one of the exhibits. And so we do find out. So the ring gets dropped in with the wolf eels. And we do find out for him that he, when he was a younger octopus, he was, I like that he says, I was young, naive, and in italics, looking for a place to crash, as you humans might put it, in the open sea. So he goes, tries to squeeze into a little rocky den, but it was already occupied by eels, and they hurt him. They hurt him, and they bite off one of his arms. So he says, I paid for my mistake 3 times. First, I paid with my pride. Second, with one of my arms. The arm started to grow back the next day, but by then it was too late. Third, with my freedom. Had my own poor judgment not brought about such injuries, perhaps I would have evaded my so-called rescue. But he braves the wolf eel tank for Tova.
And I want to say something positive also. In this part, his situation is mirroring that of Cameron's, which is a nice bit of writing craft, right? He was mirroring Tova earlier on in the novel, like with his situation. And here, that line you just read, evading my own rescue because of my rash decisions. That is what Cameron is literally in the middle of doing, is evading anything positive happening in his life by stupid, I mean, almost unbelievably stupid, far more stupid than Marcellus's decisions. But his decisions, his rash decisions are about to have him evade his own rescue that he needs. And
yes,
that's nicely
because,
done. I'll
because
say
for what it's worth with Cameron, Cameron's been at the aquarium. This is like the longest he's ever held down a job. He's gotten the camper fixed up and he's dating this nice girl who inexplicably likes him. He has Ethan who cares for him and is nice to him. Like he's friends with Tova. It's like, he's got like the nicest thing he's had going in his adult life. And he just blows it all up because he's like, oh, my girlfriend didn't text me back one time. And like this insane whim that I had turned out to be this insane assumption that I made. And this whim that I came up here on has turned out to be nothing without looking at. Look at all this like nice stuff you've accomplished in the past. Because this goes on for like 6 or 7 months that he's there in Sewell Bay. But yes,
it's not that his girlfriend didn't text him back.
He didn't text him at all.
Like she just didn't text him. And he's mad because he's just mad that he doesn't text her to be like, hey, like he doesn't text her first and she doesn't respond. I think she just hadn't texted him. And he's like, oh, she knew I was meeting my dad. How could she do this to me? How could I have no messages from her? I'm getting out of this town where only good things have happened to me and people have inexplicably been over backward to make me a functioning person.
Yeah, we get beginning of the book, Cameron comes back to haunt us at this point.
The Cameron plot lines are really my only like complaint about the quality of this book. The Tova storyline and the Marcellus storyline on their own are a little bit sweet and a little bit predictable for my tastes, but I think they work and I think that they demonstrate something that is human, that is realistic emotions and realistic choices and decisions by people. Like, I'm on Tova's side about why the shirt would be mistaken for a rag, even. Like, obviously, you put it under the sink.
Right.
It's the Cameron plot line that just feels really messy and like it was just written in a hurry to fill pages. It just, so much of it doesn't add up. I don't know. The Brinks guy who's just like my best friend in the whole wide world, I built this bar for. No, I never followed up on you, her son. Why would I do that? I've been holding this flame for my best friend. Like, I'm opening this entire bar based around a thing she said to me one time. But no, I've never followed up on you. Why should I have?
You knew this kid existed. Why have you? If you knew this kid existed and this girl meant so much to you, why have you never bothered? And you know this girl's a mess. It's not like he's like, oh, whatever happened to your mom, you know? And he's like, oh, well, it turns out she's a drug addict. Like, he knows that. He knows, like, she's not in a good way, right? So it's like, yeah, you never followed up to see, like, how her kid turned out, or, like, you never followed up with her to see if you could, like, help because you have a lot of money.
But you are building a bar for her, like a fully functioning business.
Right.
Like, with paperwork, and you had to rent a place and, like, get a liquor license. And you're not in the restaurant business, but you're doing all of this for her. You never drop this kid a postcard or an email or a Facebook message or hit him up on Insta. Nothing. You never bought a moth. You never went online and bought a moth sausage t-shirt.
All right. Well, anyway, So Marcellus gets the ring to Tova.
Right.
And she reads the inscription and puts two and two together and realizes that Eric had impregnated Daphne and that Cameron is her grandson.
Right. Because she knew that Cameron had the ring and that it was a ring that her mother had. Or I'm sorry, a ring that his mother had. She puts this together and then she helps Marcellus escape. So she puts Marcellus in a bucket. And I got to say, I like this part. I like the escape.
I do too.
It's put in a bucket.
And let me tell you something that I like about this book. I like that we don't have to watch Marcellus die.
Yeah, 100%. He's the best part of the book, I think. He's the most interesting part. He's the most creative part.
100%.
The relationship with Tova, I think works. I think it's sweet. And I like that they get... a final adventure together. I like that they team up for this adventure at the end, the great breakout, the great escape.
And I like that she puts him in the mop bucket. Because something that I think, something we haven't addressed, he's a big octopus. Like, she can't just carry him. Do you know what, like...
No, he's a giant octopus.
He's a giant octopus with all those arms and a giant mantle. She struggles. It's not like she could just kind of, like, scoop him up and go, like, chuck him over the pier. You know what I mean? It's some effort, like, to get him in the bucket. It's some effort to get the bucket down to the water. Yeah.
No, I like the metaphor in it that Marcellus is being broken out of his home. His retirement home, if we're going to like really put a fine point on it.
Mm-hmm.
This is Tova breaking out of like the way she normally behaves and ultimately lead to her decision to, she never actually goes to the home, but you know, she breaks out of the mindset that was going to have her relocate and move up to a retirement home. And together they break out of this She puts him in the bucket. She gets him out the door and she wheels him down the pier. They have an emotional goodbye. That again, I think works. It's not drawn out.
It's
while
perfect.
It is sentimental.
This is very well
cute.
Done. Yeah.
It's heartfelt.
Yeah, it works. It's the right length. It's meaningful and it's heartfelt. And then she returns him to the ocean. And don't they hold hands one last time?
Yeah, he holds on to like her wrist. That's their little thing. I just had it up. I can read it. For a moment that seems extended in time before gravity catches up, Marcellus's arm remains wrapped around her hand as his strange otherworldly body hangs in midair, his eye fixed to hers. Just as she's about to be pulled down with him, he releases and lands with a heavy splash in the night black water.
Yeah, terrific. Well done. It's exciting, it's sweet, it's sentimental, it's a good ending.
She acknowledges to him, she realizes, you led me to him. You stole his driver's license, you naughty thing. You tried to tell me and I wasn't listening.
Yeah.
So she acknowledges the work that he has done to make this happen and to give her something. So like she and Marcellus are saying goodbye, this relationship that they have had, they're saying goodbye, they're having to part ways, but he's leaving her with family. He's making sure that she has family and he's filled her heart. And I just think that's great.
It is. She saved his life. He would have died caught in those cords if she hadn't put him back in there. And then she doesn't rat on him. She saves his life and then lets him keep having the little bit of freedom that he has. And he wants to repay her. And he also likes her because she's kind and because she bothers to talk to him. And they get this great moment together at the end. And then Avery comes along the pier, I think looking for Cameron. And they start talking a little bit. And Avery tells the story again of the woman that she saw on the pier that one time when she was paddleboarding, who looked in real bad shape, who Avery kind of talked down from what she believed was going to be a life-ending decision there at the end of the pier. And that the woman kept talking about a boom. And Avery tells her she thought it must be some kind of like post-traumatic response to an explosion or a car wreck, or she served in the military, any number of things that might explain that. And Tova keeps it to herself, but she understands that it's the boat. It's the boom on the boat. And that what must have happened is that they were out on the boat together, Daphne Casmore and her son, Eric. The boom hit him and he went over and drowned, or he was killed by the boom, whatever it was. But this Daphne Casmore lost him in that moment and made it back to shore herself, but was panicked and upset and was afraid they'd think that she killed whatever it is, but didn't report it and didn't ever talk to anybody about it. And so she feels she gets a little bit of closure on what would have happened to her son, at the very least that it was not a suicide. Like she knows in her heart now that it was not some missed sadness that she, as his mother, didn't notice or put her finger on or wasn't able to like help him with or see. And so Tova gets her closure in that moment. And then Cameron comes back and decides that he's going to be a good guy after all and go back to work and not leave Terry high and dry.
Tova has taken the note saying that he was quitting, yeah. So Terry doesn't even know.
Right. And then does Tova tell him that she's his grandmother?
Yes, he comes to her house. She tells him, yeah. She gives him the ring.
She gives him the ring and she explains that it doesn't mean eels, you idiot. It's initials. It's obviously initials. Why would it say eels? It's obviously initials, Cameron. But Tova does sell her house in the end. She sells it to a nice family who's going to have a nice life there and raise their children there, just like she got to raise her child there. And instead of moving in to Charterhouse, the retirement community, she stays in town and buys a nice condo and makes a life for herself with her grandson, Cameron, now brought to her, and Ethan the grocer, who does go out of his way to buy a moth sausage t-shirt at, is it Thanksgiving where the book ends? I think it's Thanksgiving, right?
I think it's Thanksgiving, yeah.
Yeah. Cameron and Avery explain their really, really avoidable misunderstanding. And Marcellus comes back one last time to tell us that we're all remarkably bright creatures. And that's the end. It all works out for Cameron. An absolutely beyond mediocre. I mean, like so much lower than mediocre guy. It all works out for him.
I'm focused more on how it all works out for Tova, who is not alone and finds that she does have family and she does open herself. What?
No, because you're a sweeter person than I am. You're more of an optimist, but you are right. It does.
It works out for Tova, who does have some family. She like opens her heart again to be with Ethan and accept love from Ethan. And I think that's nice, even though, yeah, I don't think Cameron deserves Avery. I think Avery could do better, and I will die on that hill for sure.
I think Cameron could have stood to be maybe like 4 years younger than he is in this book. If he was like 26, maybe the man-child thing would have felt a little more natural.
If he was younger, I think I would be less irritated with him because I would be like, well, he's young. His life started off rocky because his mother is an addict. His mother just dumps him and leaves him. And he gets a decent family member out of it. And Aunt Chlamydia, who clearly loves him very much and takes good care of him. But yeah, I feel like I would, if he was a little younger, I could forgive him a little bit more. But I think that you're right. I do think it's that because he's 30, that it's just, I'm going to need you to like, do better.
And I think it's a choice. I think he's 30 on purpose in the book because he is meant to be deeply immature. Like, I think that is a decision that the author made to show just how unput together this guy is, to show that he is 30 and living this way versus 26 or 25, which might be a little more explicable.
Yeah. No, he is an unlikable character, and I had a hard time rooting for him, but I want things to work out for Tova. So I want things to work out for Tova, and I'm glad that they do.
And he is always nice to Tova. It's not like he's a son of a bitch who then has a good thing happen to him. I think it's just that his character, in order for some of the plot elements to move forward, needs to be unbelievably, not just immature, but just dumb. Like, just unbelievably dumb.
Yeah, I can give you that.
There's lots of highlights in this book that I think justify its popularity. I think most of them are in the Marcellus Tova plot lines.
Yeah, I agree. We need Cameron's storylines to come into this to fulfill the mystery and whatnot. But yeah, I think what stands out in this book, I think what speaks to people's heart, I think what makes people feel good, and I think what makes people recommend this book to each other, it's Marcellus and Tova, and it's their storylines.
And the Marcellus thing is fun because it takes what is a sort of Hallmark movie plot and adds a really wonderful weirdness to it, like this weird element that you would not normally find in something like this. The story of an older woman realizing that like she still has a place in the community and like finding family, which are nice stories, but a little bit pat and a little bit predictable.
But we add a little magical realism, an anthropomorphized animal.
Yeah.
And I do like the clever little twist that humans are the remarkably bright creatures.
Yeah, that's nice.
And that it's not that Marcellus is the remarkably bright creature.
Well, we all are, Rebecca. We're
which is what
remarkably
you're thinking.
Bright creature.
You know who's not a remarkably bright creature is Cameron.
It's true. Sorry, everyone except Cameron is a remarkably bright creature. And to some extent, I'm going to throw Ethan in there that's a ridiculous place to keep your shirts.
I mean, yeah, get your laundry together, Ethan. But Ethan is a nice guy.
Yes.
Okay, so the Bechdel test. This does handily pass the Bechdel test because of the nitwits. Because they are talking about things outside. They're talking about their life. They're talking about each other. They are talking about things outside of outside of men. So this handily passes the Bechdel.
And I'll give a little shout out to the younger female characters as well. There's fewer of them just because of the way the story's plot is structured. But Avery and our real estate agent have a conversation about just a real life thing. Like, you're my landlord, the water's cold, get it together, and so forth.
Will's girlfriend or wife, she talks to Tova. I guess they're talking about Eric, but it's not a romantic love interest. Like,
no, it's not a romantic love interest. No, I feel like that counts. Like, they're talking about a plot line that impacts Tova. They're talking about her son. And I feel like that doesn't fall into the, I know it's like talking about a man, but I feel like talking about the mystery involving your deceased son is a pass.
Yeah.
100%. And Avery and Tova have a conversation on the pier as well.
I mean, they talk about Cameron a little bit, but then they're also talking about Daphne.
Yeah. No, this one passes with no like real caveats. All right. Did you do the casting call?
I sure did. So because of the popularity of this book, if it's made into a movie, it's going to have heavy hitters. So that's what I did for casting. And
it must be in line to have a movie made. I can't imagine that it's not.
I'd be surprised if it doesn't. And so I went like current big names for my casting call. So Tova, obviously, Meryl Streep.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Right. 100%. I didn't consider anybody else. And then I did Cameron as Austin Butler because I feel like he's having a real moment. And he's good looking. And I feel that Austin Butler and Meryl Streep could be related.
I think you also need it to be someone who looks like Austin Butler to justify the romantic interest from the two women. Cameron has two relationships within the course of this like rather short novel.
With stable, decent women who were both described as being like not ugly, right? Yeah. So it needs to be somebody good looking. I think that Austin Butler and Meryl Streep could be like, I think if Austin Butler is colored the right way, hair coloring and stuff like that, that him and Meryl Streep could be distantly related since like the octopus can see that they're similar looking.
They both look vaguely sweet.
Exactly. Yes. That's kind of part of why I picked them too. Because of the Swedish background, I was like, yeah, I feel like they could be passably grandmother and grandson. For Ethan,
you could put that youngest Skarsgård.
Did
in
also
there too, the one
I
played.
Did also consider the Skarsgårds. So
They're Nordic.
Skarsgårds were in my thought process, but because, like I said, I was going for like big blockbuster and Austin Butler, I feel like is really having a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So I picked him based on name recognition. For Ethan, I went Donald Sutherland because I love Donald Sutherland. He's got a nice head of hair on him, and I could picture him like as like a Scotsman, you know?
How old is Ewan McGregor at this point? Donald Sutherland's probably
But remember that this is Stephen Hawking's casting call. So Donald Sutherland will be as old as I need him to be to participate in this movie.
Well, and I think and alive, right? Because he's dead.
Is he?
Oh, hang on. Let me check that. I shouldn't kill the guy off early. Hang on. Let's see.
Oh, no. He did. He died in. He was 88 and he died in 2024.
Yeah. Like,
all right, but
year.
Still, okay, but this is Stephen Hawking's casting call. So in the time and space that I am making this movie, I can cast Donald Sutherland. Well, let's see how old Ewan McGregor is. I feel like forgot he's Scottish.
I mean, he's not in his 70s. I know that.
No, he's 54. But again, this is Stephen Hawking's casting call. So if we aged him 16 years, he'd be the same age as Tova.
He's also just the only Scottish actor I could pull like right off the top of my head. I'm sure there's.
And then I cast Avery. This is somebody.
James Mac, too young.
I cast Avery as well. She's my last one. Because I was going for heavy hitters and like big box office names, I picked Florence Pugh. I know that you don't really care for her, but she's very like girls next. She's just very like girl. She's very girl next door. She's very girl next. Or you? Oh, it's not that you don't like her. You just said you don't fully understand why she's like quite so famous. I think that's what it is you've said about her. But she is. But she's a decent actress, and she is like girl.
She also
like,
has a very. She also has.
She's cute. Like
she has a
girl
very
next
short
door.
Neck.
She does have a short neck. Yeah, but she's like a cute. She's cute. She's a cute, attractive girl. She's cute in a girl next door kind of way. And again, some of my picking her was like, I was going for like big names. I was going for bigger names for this movie. Big, recognizable names that would make moms want to go see this movie. Moms want to go see this movie because of Tova's storyline. So we have Meryl Streep for them. And then you're going to go see it with your mom because like you both read the book and you both loved the book and then you shared the book. Then it's you got Austin Butler for the younger women. You got Florence Pugh. So, yeah. I mean, with the big blockbuster names.
I like Florence Pugh. I think she's a good actor.
She is a good actor.
She just has a short neck. All right. That's a good one. Another suggestion that I have for Ethan that I just thought of because I didn't do this, obviously. Robbie Coltrane. You might know him as Hagrid from the Harry Potter series.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he would make a good Ethan. Yeah. You know what? I did not know what he looked like as not Hagrid, so I like had to take a look. And he would have made a good Ethan. Yeah, you're correct in that. Yeah. He's been in... Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he falls into my like aging dead kind of type.
He could totally be aging deadhead. Oh, well, he's been a lot more stuff.
I'm falling
than
down
I...
a rabbit hole looking up Scottish actors.
I can see that that's what's happening. Yeah, I picture. Who else
yeah,
you got?
He was
I feel like
his
you're excited about Scottish.
Role in the state. Yeah, I did. I had a couple. Robbie Coltrane. My other one was Alan Cumming.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Also Scottish. I just like Alan. I feel like you can put him in anything. I'm always happy to see him show up. All right. I want to start. You know who you look like. You know who you remind me of.
Go for it.
I have a good one. I think it's going to blow the doors off. I think it's going to blow your mind. Where the Heart Is by Billy Letts.
Oh,
remember
that book? Wow. I do remember that book and the movie. That is first of all, that is an excellent read. But it is an excellent read in the way that this is an excellent read is that it is just good. It is a good, sweet story with good emotion behind it. That was a great call. This is the one where she has a baby in a Walmart.
Yeah, it's the one where Natalie Portman lives in a Walmart. Yeah, that's how. I saw the movie first and then read the book because it was around the house second. So characters as the people from the movie. But it has, I thought of like Where the Crawdads Sing. But I will say Where the Crawdads Sing has a certain grimness to it that this book does not have. Like this book is not, while there is a death in it and while there is a character off the page who is suffering from addiction, this is like how you just described Where the Heart Is. It's a simple, sweet story with high emotions that are, or high emotionality, but in a very local setting, right? Like it's mothers, daughters, surrogate mothers, role models, like it's all just things that could actually happen to you or people around you, right? It feels a very relatable story without the sort of gothic grimness of throwing a man off the top of a watchtower,
yeah.
Attempted rape, and so forth.
Fair.
And so that's my first one is, and you remind me of, is Where the Heart Is. I think if you enjoyed this book, you should pull that one out. I bet you can find it for a couple bucks on Thrift Books. Because it came out a little while ago. Another more recent one is Before the Coffee Gets Cold, which is by Toshikazu Kawaguchi. And I read that one for book club. It is also just very simple, sweet stories with like high emotional twists to each one of them. Again, I did not particularly enjoy it. But appreciate, like, I get why it was popular. Everyone else in book club really seemed to connect with it. If you like this, I bet you will like that. I bet you would like anything by Nicholas Sparks. And then my last one is not a book, but I bet you would enjoy the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Those are all really
solid. Which is
solid.
Also a movie that, like, not a lot happens in it, right? Like, not... Yeah. Thank you. I was pleased with those.
Yeah, you did a really nice job. And you know what I was thinking when you used appreciate and you described it as a portmanteau is that you're using one of our vocab words from tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. I remember that being one of the words that was in that yes, I remember I am, we were discussing we were discussing the vocab in that book. And I was trying to remember when you said portmanteau, I was like, oh, that wasn't something that we just, I was like, that wasn't something that we did recently for Reading Pop Classics. And it just hit me that it was tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. I only have two and mine are not as good as yours. I mentioned this one already, not a book, but the Henri the Cat videos where Henri the Cat has existential angst. And so if you are not familiar with these videos, you can look them up on YouTube. They're each like a couple minutes long, but Henri the Cat has existential angst and they're like these like film noir clips on YouTube that are narrated by the cat and his existential angst. And that voice just reminded me of Marcellus, like right off the bat. So that is one of the things that this reminds me of. And as much as I hate to do a book that we have recently done as my, you know, who you remind me of, sometimes they just go together. And this reminded me of A Man Called Ove, because we are again dealing with the storyline of an older person who feels that they've lost their place in their life a little bit and doesn't really know what comes next for them. Something that we did not address because it's not pivotal to the plot or the storyline. Tova also gets a cat in this book. A cat also just comes to her house and starts hanging out and she forms a relationship with it.
She does. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. And again, just the... So what I wrote down, and I don't mean unkindly, is the cheese factor in both of these books. Just the sweetness of the story and the just the way they hit the emotions. So I, like I said, I have written here cheese factor, but I don't mean that in a derogatory way or to put either of these books down, but just that saccharine emotionalism that is part of both of these books.
Well, I think it's a good recommendation.
Yeah, like I think if you liked A Man Called Ove, I feel that you
I
would
think
also
it's a good
enjoy
comparison.
This. Yeah, like you would also enjoy this book.
And I think you know who you are. If you are putting on the Hallmark Channel and enjoying those movies, if you're reading things like A Man Called Ove, if you've seen the movie Where the Heart Is, where Natalie Portman has a baby in a Walmart, and you're like, that was great. If you enjoyed Steel Magnolias, like you know kind of who you are, and this book is up your alley if you're one of those people. Did you have any quotes?
Just one. I did not find this to be maybe as quotable as some other things that we have read. I bet I have a feeling that part of me that thinks we might have picked the same one. It is obviously a Marcellus quote.
You go first.
All right. So it's obviously Marcellus. If there is one topic of conversation humans never exhaust, it is the status of their outdoor environment. And for as much as they discuss it, their incredulity is, well, incredible. That preposterous phrase, can you believe this weather we're having? How many times have I heard it? 1,910 to be exact. 1.5 times a day on average. Tell me again about the intelligence of humans. They cannot even imagine to comprehend predictable meteorological events. Imagine if I were to stride over to my neighbors, the sea jellies, and while shaking my mantle with disbelief, make a comment such as, can you believe these bubbles these tanks are putting out today? Preposterous. I enjoyed this for several reasons. One, because I like when he says...
Okay, that's a good one. That's not the one I have.
I enjoyed this for several reasons. One is, can you imagine me going over to the sea jellies, shaking my mantle with disbelief, making a comment? I like that. Also, I for whatever reason, in my several careers, I have jobs where I talk to a lot of people throughout the day and I have to make some small talk with them because of the number of conversations with different people that I have throughout the day. So the amount of times in the day that I talk about the weather does sometimes really wear on me. Like it is sometimes just I'm getting ready, like and it, currently maybe it's like my next patient with what I'm doing, or like when we own the yoga studio and it would be like people will be coming in for class, particularly in New York City where like people are much more affected by the weather because you have to walk around in it, that I do sometimes weary of just if I have to have another conversation about the fact that it's raining today, I'm going to lose my mind. But then at the same time, there is also, I do have to make a lot of small talk with people throughout the day. And I have had to do this in so many different jobs that it is also like, well, when you don't know what else to say and you have to make some small talk, you can talk about the weather. I did think that I liked that for many reasons. I think it's clever. I love his disdain for it and his like a little bit of disdain for humans. And again, I just really love his voice and I love his voice and I love his little chapters so much, but that one really made me smile.
That's a good one. Mine is not a Marcellus quote. Mine is a Tova. It's just in Tova's narration. And it is, Tova wonders sometimes if it's better that way, to have one's tragedies clustered together, to make good use of the existing rawness, get it over with in one shot. Tova knew there was a bottom to those depths of despair. Once your soul was soaked through with grief, any more simply ran off, overflowed. And it was one of the moments that I thought just captured, again, a true human moment from what this character would have been going through. I actually cut the very end of the quote off because the end of it's overflowed the way maple syrup on Saturday morning pancakes always cascaded onto the table. That's stupid. But if you just put the period after overflowed, then I think that is a profound and true human emotion. I think it is true about the piling on of grief, despair. And that's the one quote I could find.
All right. That I enjoyed that. I enjoyed how you just like cut off the part that you hated in the quote and kept the part that you liked. That's fair.
Would you recommend this?
Yes, I would recommend this. And I think I said this same thing about A Man Called Ove, and that there are some people that I would not necessarily recommend this to, that I wouldn't be like, oh, I think you're going to love it. But there is a number of people that I would recommend, and that this is a nice and pleasant. This is a nice, pleasant read. It wraps up nicely. It has a unique point of view.
I would not broadly recommend this just to anybody, but you know, there's people that I would definitely recommend it to, and I would probably give it as a gift to certain people in my life, knowing their tastes and knowing that this is the kind of thing that would be up their alley.
Yes, this is the kind of thing that you could recommend for a book club or for a broader... Yeah, this is the kind of thing you could recommend for like a book club. This is something you could recommend for a specific group of people, I think.
Yeah.
To All follow.
Right. So to, that was to, Remarkably Bright Creatures.
But to follow up
on...
Go
ahead.
Oh, to follow up on our mini... We had a brief conversation about how like men aren't reading as much. This is not a book that is going to make men read more literature.
No, if you're trying to solve the why don't men read fiction problem, I wouldn't start here. I don't know if this is going to quite grab them the way we're all hoping to. All right, that was Remarkably Bright Creatures. You can follow us on Instagram at readingpopclassics.com. You can write to us at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. We will be back probably with a mini-sode in about a week. And then about a week after that, we will be back with our next book, A Court of Thorns and Roses, in our main episode for one of our regular episodes. You can do your end part.
And thanks for listening.